This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Tuesday, 21st of June, 2022, and after a holiday in the U.S., a bit of loss of energy in these markets, although we did see a pretty decent brightening of sentiment in Europe and in Asia overnight. U.S. futures up a decent amount as well. So I guess the sort of at a tipping point here after that new Thursday low for the cycle last week, whether we continue down here or are in for some consolidation. Yesterday, we were speculating on a sort of narrative that could see a bit of summer doldrums, a bit of consolidation settling in. I think it's still an open question, but there's really not a lot to take from yesterday's session. Peter, latest from Bullard, U.S. Fed voter and prominent hawk. We always know that he's going to come out with hawkish views. He did the same yesterday with his comments on the Fed needing to deliver and prevent a so-called unmooring of inflation expectations. But is there anything any comments you have as a setup into today's session?
No, not really, except for that I've sorted on months to date here on slide two, our theme baskets, that China is really standing out. And we've had a relatively strengthening of the next gen medicine basket. So that's the biotechnology. It's also one of those sectors that have been hit the hardest. So there is a rebound. And I think we talked about it. I mean, the VIX forward curve is flat. The VIX is at 31. The U.S. 10-year has slowed down its rise for sure, and the rising recession fears, and we'll talk about that in a few seconds, John. Rising recession fears, I think, causing a repricing and potential some relief for equities. The commodities spot index is at the lowest levels in 3 months, taking pressure off the system and especially equities. So I wouldn't be surprised to see this equity market trying to go back, at least in the S&P 500 futures, to 3,800. Try to test that. I would definitely not be surprised about that. And then I think a lead into your slide on slide three, John, is Larry Summers, right? Because Larry Summers was talking about the age of residential inflation. We had that on chart on the in the podcast yesterday, where we talked about the rents, the second derivative, the change in rents in the U.S. is actually the biggest it has been so since the early 1980s, and it really beginning to divert to the upside from the trend growth that we have seen. So I think a very alarming signals coming from the U.S. rents, because it's 25% of the U.S. inflation basket. And Larry Summers, in a conversation, trying to get to your slide three, John, actually convinced Biden that whatever we do from here, we will go into a recession. And you have a take, or maybe we can have a little bit more colorful discussion about that. And it's not so black and white.
Yeah, and that's the problem here, because we have something like, we can point to something like housing, and draw parallels perhaps back with the previous cycle and say, oh, housing is in for a massive correction. There's no mortgage activity, et cetera, because of the massive shock to mortgage rates. But that's not the entire economy. And you can look at some of the leading indicators versus coincident indicators and say, okay, where are we in the cycle? And it's kind of unprecedented in a way to look at and compare those two very things. So look on slide three, you can see so it's a bit confusing here, but I had to put a zero axis on the left and a zero axis on the right. The zero axis on the left is for the Chicago Fed National Activity Index. It's because it has a much higher variance than the leading indicators, which are a month-on-month data series, and that's on the right. And it's just to say that we're dipping on a 6 month moving average basis to remove some of the chopping. We're dipping into the zero, below zero territory for the leading indicators, which is also what we were doing in the months leading into the pandemic. It really did look like the U.S. economy was heading towards at least a recession light ahead of the pandemic and all the craziness that ensued there. And often when that's the case, the sort of the national and the coincident activity index indicator there, the blue one, is right around zero, maybe also dipping a bit below its own zero axis. And that's what we saw back in 2019. You can see we also saw that back in 2007 when both were clearly pointing towards a recession. But right now we have this activity index indicator still just trucking along at what are very elevated levels for the entire basically history of this pre-pandemic set of statistics here we have on this chart. So the activity levels themselves are very high, and you could say maybe this is more like somewhere where we are in 2006, where we're seeing a huge tightening galloping and on the way, but it doesn't really get full traction on the economy at large until further down the road. That's one of the theses our chief economist Stan Jakobsen has as well, that the level of activity and the inflation potential here is far greater than what many believe. And that's potentially what this chart could be proving. But there's, I would say there's definitely a tension there.
I think we can agree on that, John.
Yeah. And then I think this is a really interesting discussion we had this morning, is basically on Tesla and the geopolitics of Tesla. And one of the key specific stories was actually the I don't have the details very good here, but I think it's the Chinese, basically the Chinese political higher ups. They have this big to-do at a Chinese area by Daha or something like that, where they get together and they're actually suspending or preventing, banning all Teslas from even being in the area during the entire period of this conference or activity of higher ups, I guess with the fear that there's some sort of surveillance in in Tesla cars that China doesn't want to risk. And somebody said, well, what does this say about Chinese EVs elsewhere? Anyway, it's an interesting story, but there are other angles to this geopolitical potential tension that Tesla is dealing with.
Yeah,
or Elon Musk specifically as well.
Yeah, it's more about the person, Elon Musk, because I think he's the key risk here. So we have talked about Tesla being very key for sentiment and probably the last bastion of this retail investor enthusiasm or bull market we have seen. And it's floating around the 650 level. We have highlighted the autopilot potential suspension of that. There is now, it has been elevated to an engineering probe by the US traffic regulators, and they're looking into it. And then we know that, the autopilot is a pretty big part of the operating income from Tesla right now. They're not making a lot of money on the hardware. They're selling this software at an incredible fat margin. So that's one risk. And now, I think the FT has a very, very interesting article out there. We have to highlight it because China, I think, is the second risk source. So it's the Chinese market is arguably one of the most important markets right now for Tesla. It's by far the market that have catapulted Tesla into becoming one of the most valuable companies in the world. The Chinese government have been very, very, positive and cooperative with Tesla, setting up the China factory in Shanghai with all the full supply chain, etc. But Elon Musk also has SpaceX and it's Starlink. And on the second day of the invasion, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Elon Musk said that he would send all these Starlink receivers to Ukraine and so they could utilize a 2,000 low Earth orbit satellites for Starlink. So that means basically the Ukraine army has a flawless communication basically in the military operations. And that has really set off the alarms in China from a geopolitical point of view, security angle. And they could potentially use that as an angle to actually constrain Tesla's effort because it's a different company, but it's the same owner. So I think there are two major resources now to be aware of if you own Tesla.
Certainly a very interesting story. Okay, I'm going to keep Ola parked over in the corner and get through my FX bit here. I think it's really key to point out what's going on. So we talked a little bit about, one thing that would be needed, I think, to keep risk sentiment sort of steady and consolidating. Low energy for a summer limbo period that we talked about yesterday, and that would be U.S. yields to stay low, especially at the longer end of the curve. So far, we've avoided melting down through the key yield levels, about 3.2% on the U.S. 10-year benchmark. I think if we go back to challenge the 3.5% level that was the cycle top, I think we're in for a different set of circumstances, and especially for dollar yen. And on that note, on slide 5, we've talked a lot about this, but just to point out that dollar yen is pinned back towards those highs. The Bank of Japan needing to mobilize $81 billion of intervention to keep the yield caps on its 10-year JGBs and to keep the yield curve under control. That was an unprecedented amount. It effectively shows two things. The Bank of Japan is losing control of its balance sheet with this operation, with this policy insistence, and the JGB market is completely dysfunctional. So this is all very yen negative as long as yields continue to press higher. That is the key question. For example, in Europe, they never really consolidated much at all and were back towards the highs. The ECB, President Lagarde was out yesterday and they're talking up this new tool for suppressing peripheral yields. We have the Germany-Italy spread down some 193 basis points towards the lows of the range back, stretching back to early May. And I wonder if that's as that yield is suppressed, it actually brings the risk of the core yields higher in Europe. In any case, it's an interesting signal there, and Euro yen is back under pressure to the upside. watching that. Certainly the yen situation, the dollar situation, also post FOMC, where we've been triangulating in a range. We need some resolution there. Something like Aussie dollar. You had the RBA out with some slightly dovish comments overnight that took Australian yields down. And I'll segue into OLA space on Australia in a minute. But as well, this awkward Chinese renminbi policy keeping it so strong relative to the yen, which is very interesting. That 20 level, we've been trading above that and above the really the highs of the cycle at times in renminbi versus the Japanese yen. So a lot of tension in Asia over that exchange rate. So a lot of moving parts here in FX. I suspect we get some resolution in the US dollar this week. Of course, low energy, stable sentiment, yields go nowhere. I think it gives the dollar the space to sell off and consolidate. The opposite, and the dollar is going to be raging again back to new highs for the cycle. But switching back to Australia, one of the things keeping Australian dollar under pressure is the, I certainly believe, is of course the uncertainty over China, the risk that we're facing a whole nother winter of COVID linked and COVID lockdown linked restrictions in China. But we're seeing it also in things like industrial metal prices. One of the key proxies for that is the copper price. And we're challenging these big lows in spot copper, at least.
Indeed, John, if we look at the top three miners in Australia, it's quite a significant setback they've seen in terms of their market cap. And iron ore, which is obviously a major export item out of Australia, has tanked over the past few weeks. Steel prices in China has softened. The lockdown still keeping the property sector running at a low pace. So that's impacting those miners. But we're just focusing today on copper, kind of the bellwether of industrial metals. As you can see on slide 7 here, we are once again challenging support. We've been range bound for I think almost a year and a half, and right now we're back down to that 395 level on high grade copper. You can see on the chart how significant that is, and it also highlights that we are still only had a relatively small correction following that massive run up from the pandemic lows in 2020. So even a deeper correction at this stage is not necessarily something that's going to call for the end of this bull run. That's at least not what we expect. So, but at least in the short term, the market looks somewhat challenged. So the next few days here really will be quite important whether we can stay above that 395 level.
Okay, and then you've been noting, we have these, we saw a big sell-off in crude oil late last week, certainly helping sentiment and hopes for the economy can at least rebound, or it's an expression that the recession is on the way. But the commodity spot index also being brought lower, those industrial metal prices, the crude oil correction, but also food prices have kind of gone out of the headlines, fortunately, especially for emerging market countries and frontier markets.
Yeah, it's obviously the thing with when Peter reports about stock stuff, people get happy when you talk about prices going up. People get very unhappy when I talk about prices going up in commodity space. So finally, I have some good news. Basically, we've seen some correction in food commodities over the past month. June-to-date declines, you can see here on slide 6. It's led by Malaysian palm oil, which is down around 20%. It was palm oil, edible oil, oils in general, and wheat were the big runners up when we had when the war broke out, because obviously Ukraine being massively important when it comes to exports of sunflower oil and wheat, so that was what drove the rally initially. But we've seen the market starting to ease back somewhat, and it's because we start to get some more news about the production elsewhere. And you can almost sadly say that so part of the reason why we're coming down is the fact that Russia is looking for record production. And you can obviously that would obviously show as well what would have been if Ukraine could have had a normal year, then prices would have been significantly lower than where they are right now. At the same time, it's also starting to look up, improve in the US. So all in all, just put in the wheat chart as an example. September wheat trade in Chicago. We have, as I called on Twitter yesterday, put quite a bit of a wonky head and shoulder. You'll probably be scratching your head, John. But at least we have a bottom. We have a support line, which we have broken now around that 1037. And as you can see on the chart, there is potentially a risk down to 961. So at least some good news for a change that we may see an easing of these supply constraints that we've seen now for quite a while.
doesn't look wonky at all. I mean, it looks pretty asymmetrical and then textbook, your head and shoulders there. So
thank you. Thank you.
And if we get the full technical correction, we should be down well below 800, but let's see, nothing ever goes by completely by the textbook, it seems like, in technical markets or in technical charting. All right, Peter, we've kind of talked to the earnings up this week a little bit to death, but we have Lennar up. We're a lot of talk about the U.S. Housing sector, and this is one of the big home builders, and they're up today.
Yeah, we have talked about it a couple of times today. I've inserted a quarterly overview. You can see it here on slide 8 of the fundamentals, and I don't know what to say about it. If you look at the revenue growth expected year-over-year for the coming quarters, it's almost seem like it's accelerating. I have a very hard time believing these consensus figures that are being displayed here from Bloomberg. It's the second biggest home builder in the U.S. Definitely the doubling from almost a little bit below 3 to almost 6% in the U.S. mortgage rate on average, at least, will have its toll on revenue growth and profitability for Lennar. I think the key question is on the outlook. So to what extent is the order book being impacted by this? That's the critical for understanding where the share price is going. But I think in terms of expectations, I think we're still on the downside here for Lennar, and I think it potentially that company could correct even more. But let's see. It's definitely one of those that I'm quite curious about. And if I remember correctly, they will be reporting before the U.S. markets are opening up today.
All right, we'll have to watch for that. And there's other housing related data up this week out of the U.S. The existing home sales up today. One of the problems there, it's a bit misleading at times, because you can look at the existing home sales being quite low, but there's a huge competition for properties and the actual supply is enormously limited. So it's really in the new homes area where we have to look for potential risks of oversupply and lower activity, having more meaning. We have a couple of Fed speakers out. Fed's Mester is a voter. She is out speaking later today. Bank of Japan, their lovely minutes that come after the meeting is already, a new meeting has already happened. They give you the minutes from the previous meeting, pretty useless there. And then 2 days of testimony from Fed Chair Powell. This is interesting. But in all, really looking at what is going on with U.S. yields and the U.S. dollar and whether we're settling in for some summer doldrums or whether the energy is going to come back into this market, because maybe this attempt to get some more complacency into the market on the course of the economy and inflation, it's either coming back or it's going to be brushed aside and we're back to new negative energy here. So I think that's where we're at a tilting point this week. Through Friday, I would argue. And on Friday, we do get that latest Michigan sentiment survey and their refresh of those long-term inflation expectations. These have been, from the preliminary to the final version of that survey, changed quite a bit on a couple of previous reports, I do recall. So if that goes up to 3.5%, for example, from the crazy 3.3%, that would be, that could definitely spook the market. If it recedes back to 3.1%, that could give the market encouragement. So I think that is actually a more interesting release than many would normally give this survey credit for influencing the market. On that note, it is a wrap, and we will be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.